Hello and welcome to a new episode of the East West Coffee Shop, brought to you by the Younger Generation Leaders Network. I am Nikita Gryazin, project assistant at the ELN and YGLN. Today I will speak with Lyric Jane, a new YGLN member, an entrepreneur, an engineer who founded Logically in 2017, a mobile app that identifies fake news and disinformation campaigns and thus helps us get honest and trustworthy information on the internet. Hello, Lyric.
Hi, Nikita. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you today.
I tried that app myself, and to be frank, I was quite surprised that fact and picture checking has become a reality so soon, thanks to visionary people like you. It's a great honor to have you today. Thank you for agreeing to speak with me, Lyric, and glad that you have joined YGLN.
It's honestly a pleasure, and I'm really excited that you tried out the app. Kind of most of the work that we do, unfortunately, sits behind a load of firewalls, and only a few institutions can access it. But the app is kind of a way in which we try and make our work accessible to all consumers of information. So glad you like the experience.
Before we embark on disinformation campaigns, can I please start by asking you what motivated you to create this app and combat this modern times disease, disinformation?
Yes, absolutely. I never thought 5 years ago that this is what I'd end up doing with my life, but it certainly feels like a lot longer ago than 5 years. But I think it was a series of personal but also global events that drove me to this. Unfortunately, in 2015, a bit of family tragedy due to health misinformation. My grandmother got some spurious WhatsApp messages saying, hey, drink this special green juice, give up your cancer meds, and you'll live longer. And we probably lost her a lot earlier than we ought to have. That followed by 2016, we saw, I think, two big democratic events around the world, in the European referendum in the UK and in the US presidential elections. And regardless of the results of those campaigns, that's kind of secondary. It was quite clear how much influence online content, online activity was having on that decision making. And perhaps my own experience around the European referendum was quite unique. My hometown, Stone, happened to be one of the highest Brexit voting places in all of the UK. And where I was at the time, Cambridge happened to be the highest Remain voting place in all of the UK. So the two communities of two groups of people that I was closest to in life had access to very different information online, rife with misinformation, and obviously they made very different decisions as a result of that. So that kind of nudged me in the direction of pursuing some research in this field. And later that year, I was in America, and that same kind of dynamic repeated itself. And I was at CSEL and the MIT Media Lab tinkering with kind of what technological solutions could exist to this problem area. And I swiftly came to the conclusion that AI only isn't going to achieve a lot in this space, and it's going to require a great deal of human-machine collaboration. But then with enough support and encouragement, kicked off the journey as Logically. 3-4 years later, we're here today. We're proud to be a 120-ish person organization supporting multiple countries across from America to Europe to Asia in helping identify harmful content, especially when misinformation and disinformation intersect with public health, public safety, election integrity, and national security issues. And in addition to that top-down work, we also take part in kind of initiatives like the Logically app, which is a way in which we try and provide similar technologies to end users so that they can try and verify information before they consume it, and certainly before they share it.
We are talking about disinformation, but I'm aware that this is quite a debatable and complex term, as every person is subjective and biased. In your opinion, what is disinformation? Is it a matter of perspective, or is there a clear line between what is false and what is true on the internet?
Yeah, I think it's important to maybe separate true and false from disinformation. I think true and false is definitely a misinformation problem, but in disinformation, it's more about is there a campaign at play, and what's the objective of that campaign? Mm-hmm. And if the objective of that campaign is in any way deceptive or is trying to influence audiences inauthentically, for me and for us as an organization, that's when it's firmly in the realm of disinformation. So when there is someone, there's a hypothetical designer behind the campaign, an individual, an organization, a nation state, a group, whatever, and they're trying to influence a population somewhere in the world, a demographic or people who believe something, to do something. This might mean everything from kind of mass population kind of propaganda campaigns to try and believe something to be true or something to be the case. Or this might be very subtle, almost social engineering campaigns and experiments where hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of resources are being thrown into getting one person just who has a little bit of influence to retweet something. So everything in that spectrum where deceptive methods are being used to influence people, regardless of the information being true, partly false, misleading, false, for me, it kind of lies in the bucket of disinformation. And then the misinformation challenge is more when distinguishing between, based on presently available evidence, what's true, what's false, what's misleading. And depending on the audiences that you're trying to communicate that to, which sources you select to fact check, which all that's where I think things become a little bit more ambiguous. Whereas in the realm of disinformation, it's not so much about the content, it's more about the campaign and the objective behind it.
I've also heard that the term disinformation was coined by Joseph Stalin and was first developed by the KGB propaganda department later on. Who is coining this concept now? Compared to Cold War times, is the definition of disinformation similar or different? What do you think?
Yeah, I think the lens on this has definitely changed. I think historically, disinformation and propaganda, although were used adversarially between population groups, between countries and other states and non-state actors, predominantly they were used within a country or within a region or within a demography for population control or for kind of making sure there are rebellions and those kinds of things, mainly in authoritarian governments. But there was also quite a few examples of disinformation in a militaristic context. So where you want to deceive your adversary from knowing where your assets are, from what your campaigns are, what your moves are. So that's kind of the realm it used to occupy. I think what's been fascinating over the last probably 5 to 6 years in particular has been how that's shifted almost entirely to the online realm. People still think about things like military disinformation and information operations in that kind of landscape. But predominantly when people think about disinformation, people think about social media. And a lot of that has to do with the events of 2015, 2016, and just how predominant these topics became in our discourse. So I think there was a lot of work that was done in early days, 2016, 17, to try and figure out this concept of so-called fake news. How do we break this down? How do we kind of learn to think in more precise terms about it? And a lot of work was done at various institutes to kind of come up with more formal definitions of things like misinformation, disinformation, information disorder, etc. It's definitely an evolving term, but I think one thing to certainly recognize is that it's not a new dynamic. False information has always existed. There have been politically motivated and geopolitically motivated actors throughout history who attempted to use information in different ways. I think it's part of what's new now is the technological element to it. The battlefield has completely shifted to a new landscape where our cognitive defenses aren't very well trained. If you were to give an average a piece of information and say, hey, what's true, what's false, they'd be pretty bad at actually distinguishing between them. Or if I think that's been the new dynamic, which has been very interesting to observe. And even today, it continues to shift and evolve because as time goes on, we get better at detecting certain types of campaigns, but new kinds of campaigns come into existence that things like deepfakes get. But equally, outside of deepfakes, there's other complexities that have emerged in the space. So I think it's almost where we're entering an era of an arms race of sorts between people, institutions who are behind conducting these campaigns and people and institutions who are looking to detect them. So it's fascinating to see how the space has evolved just in the last 4 years.
We are fairly aware of Brexit or the 2016 US presidential election being partly the result of disinformation campaigns. And are there any current political events that are affected by it as well? And would you see any wins that could be affected by the disinformation campaigns in the near future? For example, this year's German federal election or next year's French presidential election?
Absolutely. One thing to maybe clarify on the European referendum and the US presidential election, I think it's hard to attribute kind of, there was clearly a lot of disinformation and a lot of misinformation, but it's unclear how many votes did that flip and in which constituencies and where. So we still don't know if results would have been different regardless of the presence or absence of disinformation. There's some research, but not an awful lot. So that's a point to question still. However, it's the perceived success of those campaigns, which is why so many different actors today are pursuing these kind of campaigns. Kind of back in 2016, only I think about 12 or 15 countries were involved in these operations outside their own borders. And today that number is 80. So now if you have 80 entities with even a basic level of capability trying to influence each other's elections or other decision-making processes, it becomes a lot more complex an environment. And when you consider high-profile events, such as the German election later this year and the French elections, these are constantly going to be targeted by a variety of groups, not just nation state actors who will have certain agenda, either to spread chaos or to favor certain policy points of view, but also domestically. I think that's one of the things that's been most underestimated in recent years, how rife the domestic misinformation and disinformation environment is. So for instance, looking back into the 2020 presidential elections, there was a few foreign influence operations, but what was so different to 2016 was those influence operations did not produce as much novel content as they did in 2016. So in 2016, there were stories of all these meme factories and et cetera, being used to promote certain narratives, A/B testing them on different audiences and then amplifying it. What was interesting about 2020 was all of this was organically happening through various inauthentic communities and conspiratorial communities within the United States. And all nation state actors had to do was choose which narratives they wanted to amplify through bots or through other means. So it was kind of not deliberate coordination between the domestic environment and the foreign environment, but just correlation between them, kind of one served the purposes of the other and in furthering certain narratives. I think that's a threat vector for us to be increasingly aware of as we approach the German and the French elections. But even outside of election events, we've seen kind of high profile events happen. Kind of in the UK last year, there was 5G towers that were being burnt because people thought that 5G causes COVID. I mean, it sounds extremely silly, but people still had that view, and it resulted in kind of a threat to critical national infrastructure. And today, there's all sorts of concerns about the vaccine, and really, like, it's not kind of concerns that are somewhat well-reasoned or legitimate, saying, hey, the vaccine's been rushed and all of that. Those, again, you can reason with people around those kinds of things, but it's like, oh no, Bill Gates is trying to inject us with microchips. Those are the narratives that are overwhelmingly dominating the share of the conversation. So I think across, even outside of election events, there's kind of chronic challenges we have in public health, public safety, and critical national infrastructure and national security to try and mitigate on a continuous basis. And elections are these big flashpoints where there's a lot of risk and more needs to be done to counteract that risk, both domestically and internationally.
I'm wondering, do you mean that comparing 2016 to 2020 US presidential elections, it is now more about internal than external disinformation campaign, and this is the main difference?
It's a new complication. Kind of as soon as something becomes internal, you have insider risk within your own country or within your own demography of people experimenting with these tactics. So one of the challenges has been the how accessible the tools to conduct these campaigns have become. So if tiny groups can now conduct campaigns almost as effectively as nation state actors, you clearly now have a lot more risk because random actors, even if people are just trolling, can become part of that ecosystem and share that noise. I think the subtle thing that's been new has been, I think overall the quantum of foreign influence has been the same. The quantum, the quantity and the volume of domestic disinformation and misinformation certainly increased. But I think the new dynamic was novel content being produced less frequently by the foreign influence operations, whereas their teams and the entities behind them simply started looking at the domestic environments in each country. Oh, this anti-vax narrative or this QAnon narrative seems to be doing quite well. Let's amplify it and throw some more oxygen behind it by either getting state media or by getting bots or others to discuss those talking points, just to give it more oxygen. So I think that was a subtle but interesting change in tactic from trying to do everything, to from originating the content, targeting the communities and amplifying, to letting the organic stuff happen within those communities and then picking and choosing which ones needed to be amplified. So effectively it allowed some of these actors to conduct more efficient disinformation campaigns because the domestic environment was doing their work for them. And that challenge is not it's unique to the American situation. It exists in the German and the French context as well. And there's added complexity in the German context and in the French context as well, because there's so many other stakeholders involved. Europe is certainly going through an interesting time right now.
I see that the role of technology AI in the case of Europe is definitely crucial, but to what extent does it really fight disinformation campaigns, fake news, and so on? And how much technology helps us detecting and mitigating it? Of course, current disinformation campaigns require advanced technology to tackle that, but how much can we rely on AI, and are the results reliable enough?
Yeah, that's really a big question. I think fundamentally on the use of technology here, I think it's very much needed. It's kind of if the threat actors are using technology, it's almost natural to say yes. The defensive side of this needs to have some technological element as well. And historically, there's been very limited. There's been kind of basic social media monitoring, looking at trends and all of that, which does a little bit, but it doesn't really go into the granularity of how these campaigns are constructed. In the kind of work that we do, there's two ways of looking at our work. There's kind of tactical, daily, hey, today, here's the big risks that we face. This threat actor is up to this, or this narrative is getting this much prominence, and let's triage it. Let's make sure that this is actually a threat, and make sure that it's a threat that's not just affecting two people in a country, but is impacting a significant chunk of the population. And now that we've validated it's a threat, what can we do about it? Like, what action can we take? Like, can we publish a fact check? Can we work with a platform to escalate that through their content moderation team somehow? Can we work with law enforcement if it's not just kind of harmful content, but or outright illegal content? So those are the kind of incident management processes that we've really worked on, and I think where technology helps. Kind of most governments, etc., and even platforms can throw 10,000 person teams at this problem, but the problem that just throwing bodies at this doesn't solve is the speed of that entire workflow. So historically, the way in which these processes have been happening is something gets published either by a threat actor or just organically. It then spreads into a certain population or to a certain number of people. That then triggers an alert for an analyst saying, oh, yes, let me look into this. Let me figure it out. That analyst then takes a few hours to figure it out. It then takes them a few hours to say, hey, what do I do about this? And then they talk to a platform or to a law enforcement entity, and then it takes another half a day. And by the time in which something gets done, it's been a day already. And the way in which digital media works, it's already gone viral. Everyone who's had to see that content has already seen it. And any action that they take at that stage is just cleanup activity. It's not actually making a difference. So our whole emphasis in that tactical day-to-day management use cases, how do we use technology to just compress this to within half an hour or within the hour of it, of something going online, or even preemptively, how can we look at it? How can we monitor it? How can we triage it? How can we assess the risk? How can we quantify the risk? And then how can we deploy some kind of countermeasure all within that period? Because usually within half an hour, it's in the pre-viral stages, and usually any harm can be contained. And then the other emphasis of our work is kind of strategically, okay, here's our threat actors that we're looking at. Here's the vulnerable populations we're looking at. And here's the tactics that we're looking at. How are these changing month on month, quarter on quarter, year on year? So I think those are the two areas where technology really can help. And in recent years, kind of we've done a lot of work on elections, for example, kind of in outside of the European context, like in India, for example, there was, I think in a single month, we identified 150,000 pieces of false media. And this was not even political stuff. This was simple stuff like, hey, your voting station's moved, your polling booth has moved from this location to this location. So outright kind of voter suppression stuff, say, these are kind of very detectable types of campaigns. And slowly we're seeing some initiatives being rolled out across the world in safeguarding elections, because I think many recognize this as a big vulnerability, and kind of provably technology can really help in those high risk situations.
While we are coming to the end of our podcast, I also wanted to ask you for advice for all of us, ordinary social media users. What can we do now to stay away from disinformation campaigns and false information on the internet?
Yeah, it's quite tricky. I think my answer historically used to be be skeptical of everything, but that can go wrong as well. If you're super skeptical about everything, you stop trusting anything and you end up becoming super conspiratorial. So be skeptical, yes, but in moderation. But also when you're inspecting a piece of content, Jen, just kind of try and analyze who's behind that content, why you're seeing that piece of content, because usually you're seeing it for a reason. And what that content is. So if a content is kind of unusually good at firing up some emotions within you, be cautious of that. It probably means it's been designed to do that, either by just like a marketer or by someone who's using it for more deceptive purposes. So especially when things stir up emotions and stuff, let's pause, let's try and kind of get the other side of the story, and then let's rely on kind of communities and third-party tools and things like that. To try and kind of take the immediacy for reaction out of the tail, because the worst thing we can do at that point is then share that piece of information to 100 different people. It's to kind of let's slow down this process. Let's assess it ourselves. Let's take our time. So that'd be my advice. Be skeptical, but also look at the who, what, and why, and take time. Best things come in sets of three, I guess. So those are three things.
Thank you, Lyric Jane, for joining me in this episode of the East-West Coffee Shop. We hope you, our listeners, enjoyed this episode, and please tune in for our upcoming conversations. If you'd like to learn more about the YGLN, please go to our website www.europeanleadershipnetwork.org and follow us on Twitter at YGLNTweets. Thank you.